Hey, what's up, everybody? It's Dirt. Want to thank you for taking some time out to listen to the podcast of our show, brought to you by Les Schwab Tires, doing the right thing since 1952.
This is Dirt and Sprague.
In other news, the Prime Minister of Sweden visited Washington today, and my tiny little nipples went to France.
With Andy Dirt Johnson and Brendan Sprague.
You might have noticed I've got a slight weight problem.
No.
Yeah, I do. Where I went to this doctor, he told me I swallowed a lot of aggression along with a lot of pizzas. Pizzas.
Dirt and Sprague on 1080.
I want to party with you, cowboy.
If the two of us together... Get it.
The Fan.
All right, welcome back in. Second hour, Dirt and Sprague here on Portland Sports Leader, 1080 The Fan. Brandon Marcello wrote this really good piece on 24/7's website about the top 10 Pac-12 players for 2020. He's got some honorable mentions as well at the bottom, but we just tweeted it out. You can find it. We discussed it yesterday, and just the kind of thing that stuck out for me was no quarterback. I mean, you got one quarterback in Keaton Slovis, but it's a defensive and other skill position heavy list, and it's really well done. So Brandon joins us now. Brandon, good article. We enjoyed reading this and talking about it yesterday. So thanks for hopping on with us today. The only one I think we disagreed on was not having Holland in the top 10. Just out of curiosity, when you do lists like this, do you have like a second guess once you publish it and go, maybe Javon Holland should have been on that list?
Yeah, and I put him in my also considered category. He's my first guy outside. I kind of just went with my gut and based off of kind of what I expect to be the top players on each team and how important they're going to be.
Yeah.
And that's why I've got a guy like CJ on there. And even though he's been battling injuries and everything, I just think that he's probably going to be a little bit more involved with the offense this year with Justin Herbert out. So I was kind of deciding actually between the two of them, even though they're on the same team. And I end up going with CJ just because I think he's going to be so much more important and probably going to be a bigger part, for that team as of I see it right now. Heading into the season.
Yeah, and it was fascinating to see only one quarterback on the list when you think of the last handful of years and all the great quarterbacks that have come and gone through the conference and guys playing at the NFL level now. But if you were to re-rank this, let's say halfway through the season, I'm curious, how many quarterbacks do you think would crack your top 10?
I could definitely see Jaden Daniels on there. I do wonder about Chase Garbers potentially being the guy that makes that leap. I know he was a little inconsistent, but I like his moxie, the way he competes. So I think he could be a guy that's definitely on that list as well. So those are kind of the three guys I'm looking at the moment. USC is going to be doing great there. I think that they're still going to have pretty successful year in the passing game. I just wonder about some consistency there as far as trying to keep the interceptions down. But with that receiver core, I think they're going to do just fine. But to me, I think the guy that could make the biggest leap is Chase. But I think Jaden Daniels, he has an opportunity to actually maybe be the best quarterback in the conference when all said and done, if he ends up leading Arizona State to a divisional title.
Yeah, be fun to watch, no doubt. Brandon Marcello, 247sports.com, top 10 Pac-12 player ranking here. It's really good. We brought this up, but I want to pick your brain because you work for 247 Sports, so you would maybe have some information on this more than us. Interesting, because these kind of lists, when they get made from the conference in years past, it always sticks out that like half or slightly more than half are quarterbacks. This conference very good at producing quarterbacks. Just they haven't been in the championship game in a while, and they're not really a contender on the level of the Clemsons, the Bamas, the Ohio States, etc. What do you think it says about the conference, though, that when you put this list together, you're getting heavy defensive players or line players? What does that say about the conference, if anything?
Yeah, I think it's shows you the conference is changing a little bit. And I think that change starts with Oregon and what they've been able to do the last couple of years in the trenches, and not necessarily saying that everybody's following them, but it's put more of a focus, at least from the Nationals perspective, on, wow, the Pac-12 is a much more physical league in the trenches than what we've been accustomed to seeing over the last 10 years or so. I mean, if you just look up and down that list, like you say, a lot of defensive players, but also even in my list of considered players, I've got two linebackers in there, and I've got another defensive end, I mean, to me, this is a league that's you're starting to see the identity transition a little bit. And I think Oregon, in some ways, is leading that transition. But also, you know, you look at USC, obviously, they've always been a team that's been pretty good in the trenches for the most part. Same with Stanford. But when you got Oregon, a team that's, quote unquote, been finessed more often, referred to as a finesse team more often than not, then they just come through a year where they probably, or as Mario Cristobal told me, it's the best offensive line he's ever coached or ever been around during his coaching and playing career. It gets a lot more attention, and I think that it most deservedly so in the Pac-12, where you're seeing a lot of these big-time stars stepping up, and not just at Oregon, as I mentioned, but heck, I mean, look at Oregon State, the linebacker spot as well.
Yeah,
I think that this is a conference that's on its way up in playing defense. And look at Cal. I mean, goodness gracious, you go from Cal just scoring points in bunches, can't do anything on defense, to all of a sudden it's one of the best defenses in the country. There's a little bit of a sea change going on in the Pac-12.
Yeah, the transformations are pretty incredible. I've been watching Oregon football my entire life. Went to the University of Oregon. I've followed them closely. I've never and can never remember a season in which coming in the most hyped player was an offensive lineman, and far away their best player was an offensive lineman. On that note, just where does Penei Sewell rank for you amongst the players that you've seen through this conference the last couple of years, and then how big is your gap between everybody else and him at number one?
Well, I think with Penei Sewell, I mean, he's the type of player that, I mean, he's already cemented himself as potentially one of the best offensive linemen we've seen come out of college football in the last 4 or 5 years. So I think it's very possible he could be a guy that's getting Heisman votes, and not just Heisman votes, but who knows, if they get 5 or 6 guys and let 5 or 6 guys go to New York, maybe he's one of them. Obviously, I don't think he'll win it because it's pretty much a quarterback award these days, but he's phenomenal. And what's going to be interesting is just how he kind of adjusts to this new life where he's the only returning starter for Oregon. Plus, he's got a new quarterback he's got to protect in the backfield. If he could continue to play the way he's been playing, I mean, you have back-to-back years in which he's posting like Pro Football Focus had him, gave him an overall grade of 95.5, which is the highest grade they've ever given out to an offensive lineman for an entire season. If he's anywhere close to that again this year, I think he definitely should be getting Heisman votes.
You know, there's so much unpredictability at the quarterback position for all the teams in the country that are looking for new starters, Brandon, but I did want to ask you this. How many teams in your mind, if any, would you say going into the year you would put in the serious national title conversation, or is there none?
I'd say Oregon and then USC if they can get it together. But here's the thing, USC, I mentioned this in several previews I've done. I just don't trust Clay Helton to get it done. I don't care who the players are on the roster. Maybe that's just naive of me to think that, but I think Oregon's the one hope for the Pac-12 this year, and we'll see. But even for Oregon, I don't think you're going to need stellar play at quarterback to be a potential playoff team this year. I think if Oregon could just avoid some missteps and obviously get past USC down the road, then Oregon should be in the playoff. But the issue with the Pac-12 is there just seems to be that stumbling block against a team that you should beat. And then it's hard to overcome that in addition to maybe an early season loss to a conference opponent. But for Oregon, you know, it isn't like you're playing an Auburn team that was like top 10, maybe top 15. You're going to be playing a team early in the season that's already considered a national title contender. So that loss, if you lose, number one, wouldn't it be one that kind of writes you off and you have to win out? I still think maybe a 2-loss Pac-12 team could get in, but that team would have to be Oregon based off the schedule.
Interesting. Yeah, it feels like the USC stuff, we always say they're great, but there's always a qualifier whenever you talk about them that's holding them back. Is there a team, and I think somebody, it might have been you or somebody else at CBS that wrote about Cal being potentially a dark horse. I mean, where do we see kind of a dark horse coming from this conference, if there is one?
Yeah, I've actually, my Pac-12 predictions that I posted last week, I had Cal pretty high up there. I think them and Arizona State are going to be contenders that don't necessarily come out of nowhere, but are going to beat up on some teams and kind of, grind them out a little bit. And I like Cal coming into this year in a situation where, one, they've got experience returning everywhere. I think they're the most experienced team returning in the Pac-12 on both sides of the ball. Their defense is maybe not going to be as good as it was last season, but should still be top 15. And the offense will get better with Chase at quarterback. I think Cal is a team that could very well sneak up and beat some opponents. And in fact, a couple weeks ago, I did my top 20 games of the season coming up this year, and two games involved Cal, which I never thought I would put on there, at least one, even one game maybe, but I put two on there. I think Cal's got an opportunity here to shake things up and potentially get its name back on the map and do so by not scoring 35, 38, right. 40 points a game, but scoring 28 or 30 and their defense holding opponents down to 14 points.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting to see some of these teams. As you mentioned, Oregon and Cal, two teams a lot of people are looking at this year. Brendan Marcello, 24/7 Sports, CBS Sports as well. Top 10 Pac-12 player ranking. We tweeted it out. You can find it at 247sports.com. Brandon, you're a great writer, man. Thank you for hopping on with us and talking some college football, mainly Pac-12. And we'll have to get you back on once the season gets going.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me anytime.
Appreciate it. There we go. Good stuff from Brandon Marcello, 24/7 Sports. His list was fun. We discussed it yesterday, and we wanted to bring him on, talk some more football, and kind of get maybe some reasoning. Said Javon Holland was the tough one. It was kind of between him and C.J. Verdell. He just feels that Verdell is going to have a big opportunity this year being the star back, and it's tough. Holland's on his, you know, next up list. So it's not like he's completely dismissing Javon Holland.
Everybody's going to have a different opinion on stuff.
But, you know, I find the development of other positions growing more and more within the conference. And I was kind of glad he kind of shared that sentiment with me on, you notice that it's not just quarterback heavy anymore. Now it's defensive linemen and it's offensive linemen and it's defensive players. That's new for the conference. There's a shift coming.
It is funny when you think of Cal and Oregon and where they were 6 years ago to where they are now and the transformation.
Offense, offense, offense. Now it's kind of defense, defense, line play.
Yeah,
right?
Building it big up front, playing good defense. It is amazing the transformation. Oregon used it to their advantage last year, and I think Cal would have had a really special season if Garbers would have stayed healthy, and they're a clear dark horse in the conference this year. I you know, the making the playoff stuff is what we're always going to talk about and focus on. Can you get back over that hump? USC has the talent to do it, but as we just talked about with him, there's always a but. Can they avoid a letdown? Can they avoid a distraction? Can Clay Helton get them there? Is he a good enough head coach? There's always a but that's involved with them. And I think the but for Oregon this year is their quarterback play. And their season might end up coming down to what level do they need out of that position. We talked about it yesterday. I don't think that they can go on a good run if they get bad quarterback play. They're not that talented. But they do have, I think, top to bottom, the best roster. What level of quarterback play do you need? Is like a good but not great quarterback play?
I would say you need a B-minus at the worst,
right? Is it B-minus enough to get you there? Is it C-plus enough to get you there? I don't think you need an A because, again, I think your roster is talented enough. You're probably going to need an A against Ohio State because Ohio State's better than you. But I think that's the fascinating question about Oregon this year. It's just what do they need out of Brown or Shuck, whoever wins the job, in order to go on one of those kind of runs and get over the hump?
Well, coming up next, what the headline? And I have a bad feeling Dirt's going to be able to pick it, but these are three great headlines. And we'll play this game. We'll have some fun with it. And we got some sad news to pass along in the Portland area. And Maria Konnikova, who wrote the book My Biggest Bluff, or The Biggest Bluff, about learning how to play poker and actually winning a big tournament after learning. So all that is ahead. Dirt and Sprague, we're back with more on The Fan. Some bad news to pass along before we get to what the headline. Let them run the jungle. Montage has announced that they're closed forever.
That sucks, man.
Yeah.
I've had a lot of late night dinners at Montage.
Say, has anybody in Portland of age not ended up at Montage for mac and cheese at 3 in the morning
at some
point?
The late night eatery is done.
You love it. They were open all night.
Yep. And then you get your leftovers. They do the little
tinfoil swan.
Cool. You wake up hungover the next morning and eat it again. It's a great restaurant.
Also a perfect vibe. I mean, Swag's right. If you didn't have a 1 a.m., 1:30-ish night, where you, oh yeah, Montage.
Yeah.
And you walk in with the candle lit. It's like a smooth, nice, cool environment with bomb-ass food.
Yeah, great location, too.
Mm.
Yeah, that's a
COVID.
The frog legs. Where else are you going to get frog legs?
Yeah, the red beans and rice. God, the oyster shooters were good. Damn it. As my brother-in-law points out, this is the first person in my life that COVID has killed.
The Montage.
Big Montage fan.
Big Montage fan.
Big Montage fan.
Yeah, you got to be a Montage fan.
Maria Konnikova, author of a few different books, but her latest one, The Biggest Bluff. She's going to hop on with us coming up at the bottom of the hour.
I'm excited for this one.
Yeah, she learned how to play poker, and then she won a tournament, like a legit tournament, not just some 10-person tournament. She entered into this thing and struck it big. So she'll join us at the bottom of the hour. All right, it's time for What the Headline. Now, full disclosure here, I'm 0-2. I don't know why, but I think you're going to get today's.
I have a tendency to see random headlines and they stick out. I very rarely actually read the story.
I did a lot of digging in the last week.
Okay, let's see what you got.
I've holstered some things, and I don't think you're going
to
get it.
That's a good one to do, is to try and hold on to them for a couple of weeks, because I have a terrible memory and I will forget them.
I've discovered different websites that I'm kind of thinking you've never visited.
Okay.
So we'll see. First one, Dateline, Florida. Woman sues for paternity test on sheep. She wants her sheep tested. Are those really the parents? I don't think so. Dateline, New Jersey. My Little Pony fans are ready to admit they have a Nazi problem. Dateline.
Little Pony Nazis, okay.
South Dakota. Recent study finds the name Karen has grown in popularity in rural counties.
I would like to congratulate you for the first time. I do not know the answer, but I will take a guess. Do you know the answer?
I think I do.
Now, is it a guess or have you seen it?
Well, no, you go second.
I thought I saw something.
Dirt goes first. I want to see which...
Suing over a paternity test about a sheep. Yeah, Little Pony Nazis.
I gave you...
Karen popularity name. I'm going to go ahead. I'm going to play... I'm going to go reverse logic here, okay?
Okay, think aloud.
Karen popularity name rising. Not buying that in any way, shape, or form.
In rural counties in South Dakota.
Still not buying it.
What kind of counties?
Rural.
I'm going to go ahead and cancel out the Karen story.
Okay.
Suing over the paternity of a sheep is a great headline.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know any reason why that would actually be the case. So I'm going to eliminate that, and I'm going to land on, for some reason, I don't know anything about My Little Pony, but I'm going to say, hey, maybe there's some Nazi ponies out there. I'm landing on that one.
I think Dirt's right.
Did I get it right?
You're going with the same answer?
Yeah. How many sheep are in Florida?
Oh, good point. I didn't even connect those dots either.
You don't think there's farms in Florida?
I mean, there could be, but...
Yeah, I just don't think there's a lot of sheep in Florida.
They farm gators down there.
What other state would this happen in, though?
Yeah, Florida. The Florida part was convincing.
No, Florida was great, but the sheep part. Yeah.
I hate you guys.
Got it right. No, I answered. I mean, you should be proud of me. My logic was sound.
Should I be proud?
I thought I saw some headlines
somewhere.
By the way, suck on this fat one swag. Woman sues for paternity test on goats in Florida.
There you go. Not sheep.
What? There's goats, but not sheep?
Same thing.
Yes. You think a sheep's going to have all that wool down in Florida? Come on.
They shave the wool here in the summer when it gets hot. You don't think there's any sheep in Florida?
Not hot. No, there's not sheep ranches.
Oh. No.
We got one of those in Oregon. Hey-o!
Yeah, we played it. There's like 18 sheep farms in Florida.
Can we get to why the Little Ponies are Nazis?
I hate both of you.
I want to know the story. By the way, the name
Karen has died out. That's actually the real story, and it's not South Dakota. They did a study. The name Karen is going extinct.
There's a lot of those names, though. Like, you think of people that are, you know, probably 60-plus. There's a lot of those kind of names. Like, my mom's name is Sue. There's no new Sues.
There's names that are dated a little bit, you know, like...
I don't know any young Sues.
There's no young Susans.
Even young Susans.
No.
Yeah.
No
young Karens.
All right, how about this one? My Little Pony fans have had a Nazi problem for a long time, so I'm going to read this. This is from The Atlantic.
Okay.
Sounds like a strange, made-up story... Because My Little Pony is a fictional cartoon about friendship, compassion, and a group of magical horses with names such as Twilight Sparkle and Fluttershy, who live in a fantastic land called Equestria. But there's a group of males who are dedicated to this show, and they're called Bronies.
Hmm?
They've been referred to as this for nearly a decade. Most of them are white men. and they're very vocal white supremacists.
What?
The brony subculture is about as niche as they come, born in interest or internet forums in the early 2010s, an era where hyper-specific interests were the organizing principle of social media. Even so, bronies have long captured the world's attention. They hold well-attended fan conventions. They've been the stars of multiple documentaries. Many of the show's adult fans genuinely enjoy My Little Pony and the wholesome escapism it provides. Others, however, delight in the irony of their fandom. To them, it's edgy and provocative to be an adult obsessed with cartoon ponies.
This is the weirdest thing I've ever heard.
This is where Nazis come in. My Little Pony fans primarily express their enthusiasm for the show by sharing their own cartoon drawings of the main characters, which they usually upload to the image boards. The most popular of these sites is called Derpy Buru.
What?
It's a combination of characters' names and common term for image boards. This group of bronies likes to go super heavy on Nazi imagery on their version of My Little Pony horses.
So they come up with their little ponies and they put like swastikas on it?
Basically, yeah. Yeah. For years, it's been status quo in the world of My Little Pony and supposed difference to principles of free speech and openness on the internet. The presence of self-described Nazis within a fandom that idolizes compassion-oriented cartoon characters has become an accepted fact.
What the hell is wrong with people?
So My Little Pony fans, there's a chunk of them that are white supremacist Nazi believers.
How do the creators of My Little Pony feel about this story? Are they going to like tie in anti-Nazi stuff into their shows? I don't know anything about My Little Pony.
Yeah, I can't fathom it. It
is it
sits
just a
well.
Show they dance around.
I mean, how would you feel?
How
would you feel?
I think you need to tie something into the storyline just to piss them all off, right? If you find out and it's known that Nazis like your show.
By the way, you're a Nazi and you're openly like proud that you watch and still like My Little Pony?
It's not normal.
Kind of speaks to Nazis in general,
I think. It's not normal. I'm also a little concerned that apparently there was some line in there before you got to the Nazis that said there are adults that like My Little Pony just because they like the childhood nature
escapism.
Of it. The escapism of
so
it?
Is
that a real thing?
Okay, I'm not taking a shot. This is part of the story. Escapism in this sense is basically compared to adults who love and are obsessed with Disneyland. It's an escape from adult life, and it brings back childhood memories.
Okay.
It's a way to escape.
And so they watch
It's obviously
My Little
different,
Pony.
So don't text me like, I love Disneyland, how dare you? But it's like the people who openly go to Disneyland like 4 to 5 times a year.
I have a cousin like that.
That's called escapism. They love to escape reality and surround themselves with warm, fuzzy feelings and childlike, memories.
Okay, yeah, I have a cousin like that, and that's a big thing for her. I think they go multiple times a year to like Disney World. I'm pretty sure her wedding. I got hammered at it, but I think her wedding was a Disney themed wedding.
What is that? You show Mickey ears?
No, it was like a princess kind of vibe to it.
Did you dress as Prince Charming?
I did not, because I was not the groom. Believe it or not, did not marry my cousin, but. Yeah, I'd never really...
Good to know.
I did not have a word or a phrase for that, but I guess that does kind of make sense.
Is there a weirder genre of fan to be Nazis than My Little Pony?
Yeah, what's the show that would stand out worse than My Little Pony? Caillou? That's the only other kid show I know about because you
At least
the Caillou's theme song.
He's a skinhead. He's got no hair.
Touché. He fits so right in.
It would kind of make sense.
Yeah, what other shows would be... there would be like a Mr. Rogers Neighborhood kind of thing too, like if Nazis were really in on that show randomly.
Right.
Because the messaging's not really vibing.
Let us show you what we really do with Mr. McFeely.
We put our sweaters on and watch Mr. Rogers.
Get out of here, Baker Acre. You're not white enough.
You blew my mind with that headline in that story. I never thought in my radio career that I would be talking about, in the same segment, My Little Pony and Nazis. I'm glad I was able to guess, but you found one that I did not see ahead of time.
I'm really pissed. I don't think I'm going to get one. I really don't.
You'll get one. Stick with it.
Okay. That's what the headline. Coming up next, Maria Konnikova wrote the book, The Biggest Bluff. She had no idea how to play poker. She learned, wrote about her experience, entered a tournament, and then won it. We're going to talk about this next. Dirt and Sprague back with more.
Hey, welcome back in 131. Hope your Wednesdays are going well. We saw a headline about this book a couple of weeks back. We got really excited. We reached out and found out we were able to have the author on and got really excited about it. And it's a fascinating story. We talked about it on the show for like a half hour. What would you want to invest time in to learn more about and how good could you get? And joining us now, Maria Konnikova. You can give her a follow on Twitter, at M. Konnikova. She is a New York Times best-selling author, a contributor to The New Yorker, and her newest book is entitled The Biggest Bluff, How I Learned to Pay Attention, Master Myself, and Win, came out yesterday. You can find it everywhere you get books. Maria, thank you so much for the time. We really appreciate it. I kind of want to just backtrack and ask you, what was the reasoning for this? What made you want to dive into a topic like this, learn how to play poker? How did this all come about?
It's a great question. And it's not like I just wanted to learn some skill and spend some time doing something random. Really, I wanted to write about luck and about the role that luck plays in our lives. And I wanted to try to figure out, can we figure out where skill ends and chance begins? What are the limits of what we can control? And that's a really, really big topic. So I needed a way into it. And I started reading about game theory and came across John von Neumann's work. And John von Neumann, who's one of the fathers of game theory, was a poker player. And he loved poker. And I found out that game theory actually came out of poker because von Neumann thought that poker was just the perfect analog for human decision making. It was a game of incomplete information where there are things I know, there are things you know, there are things we both know. And we try to figure out, well, what do you know? And how do I make the best decision I possibly can, given that I'm never going to know everything? This sounded really interesting to me. And I thought, hey, maybe this is a way into the topic. So I started reading about poker. And I thought, bingo, I'm going to learn this game. I'm going to find someone who can teach me. I'm going to dive in. I'm going to see what I can do. And I'm going to use it as a way of exploring this question of skill versus chance. And it was supposed to be just 1 year. And instead, I found myself as a professional poker player 3 years later.
Now, I have to ask, as somebody who plays poker, how much did you learn? How much is skill? How much is luck? How do you break down the percentages?
It's a really difficult thing to answer because the answer depends on your time horizon. In the immediate term, so one hand, one tournament, one game, the luck factor is huge. And anyone can win. You know, I can sit down with my coach, Eric Seidel, and beat him, even though he is a million times better than I will ever be. Just because in the immediate term, luck is huge. But if he and I were to play 10 times, 100 times, 1,000 times, he's going to take all my money. Over the long term, it's really a game of skill, and the variance really evens out. But in order for that to happen, you do have to look at a longer time horizon. So I always recommend that people not take, you know, pick one tournament and say, yeah, I'm amazing, I did well, or, oh, I suck, I didn't do well. And instead try to say, okay, let's look a little bit further ahead, because the only way you're going to be able to tell if you are actually skilled at this is if you keep doing this and you see whether you're emerging as a winner or a loser.
Well, Maria, I think it's interesting because we applied this when we talked about this topic and we put it to other sports. So like golf is a pretty big sport for us for our hobby. We love to play golf in our off time. I'm not a very good golfer, but I'm trying to get better. And we talked about how many hours would it go into the range and practice putting and then actually playing on different courses. What goes into learning and becoming good at poker? Like when you say you train for a year and you learn all the nuances, what is like a typical day for you in the first couple weeks of learning poker?
Well, the first couple of weeks was probably pretty different for me than for most people because I knew nothing. I didn't know how many cards were in a deck. So when you talk about starting from zero, I mean, I'm starting from absolute zero. So at the beginning, it was a lot of reading. Eric Seidel, who was my coach, gave me some books on poker strategy. You know, I read The Basics, Harrington on Hold'em, and I really read them. So I didn't just skim the books. I took notes. I took margin notes. I asked questions. And then I sat down with Eric, and we went over all my questions, and we talked through the theory, and we talked through what was going on. And once he had a good handle on the fact that I wasn't just going to completely lose my shirt, he said, okay, now start playing. And I started off playing online. So I would actually go to New Jersey every day because online poker is legal there and it's not legal in New York. Yes, it is quite funny. I was amused as well. I was reverse commuting to Hoboken and sitting in cafes so that I could play poker. And I would record by hand. I would actually record my screen so that I could then go over it with Eric and we could figure out what I had to work on, what mistakes I was making, how I was thinking through things. And that was the early part of my learning process.
We're talking with Maria Konnikova. She's a New York Times bestselling author, a New Yorker contributor. Her latest book, The Biggest Bluff, How I Learned to Pay Attention, Master Myself, and Win. Started at a base level of zero playing poker, learned all about the game, ended up having some pretty good success. You can give her a follow on Twitter at mkonnikova. Now, if my information is correct, I believe I read that you started entering tournaments and you ended up winning some pretty sizable tournaments. What was that experience like for you? And then what was the reaction? I don't know what these – I've never been on like a poker circuit and played in any tournaments myself, but was there like a reaction from other people like, who is this person and how is she coming in here and winning this?
Yes. I mean, it was surreal. So I won my first major international title almost exactly a year from the first time I ever entered a casino and sat down at a poker table. And it was a big one. It was the PCA National Championship, which is the Poker Stars Caribbean Adventure. And I went through a field of hundreds of people, and the final table had all these people who I knew. I'd watched them play on TV, and I just thought I was going to absolutely get crushed. And the fact that I managed to win was just mind-blowing to me. And yeah, everyone was like, who in the world is this person? And why did she luck box this thing? You know, she doesn't deserve it. I should have won. I'm better than she was. And you know what? A lot of them probably are better than I was. But that actually got the world's attention, the poker world's attention. And after that, I got a sponsorship from Poker Stars. So I joined Team Pro, and I spent the next year, I spent 8 months out of the year traveling the circuit and playing in major events. And I wanted to do it because I actually wanted to prove to myself that I wasn't just lucky, that I could replicate this. And I did. So within 2 years, I ended up winning over $300,000 playing poker.
That was
incredibly gratifying. Wow.
So, okay, the natural follow-up to that, Maria, and look, we've read about your backstory, how accomplished you are as a writer. I mean, how do you go on tour and then not say, well, I'm done writing. I'm dominating poker now. So it's the next stage of my life. Are you smoking cigarettes now? Like, what's life like for you becoming a pro poker player?
I'm not smoking cigarettes. And I love writing. Writing is what I do. It's what I am. I would, you know, I'd feel like a part of me was missing if I stopped doing it. So it was one of these things where I felt like it was time to step back a little. 8 months of the year traveling is a lot. It takes a toll on you. It's exhausting. And so I just thought, you know what, it's time for me to take a step back to actually write this damn book and do what I was supposed to do a few years ago, which I did. And, you know, I had no desire. I wasn't going to be stopping playing poker. I had this idea that my book was going to come out. It was June 23rd, the middle of the World Series of Poker. I was supposed to be in Las Vegas right now. I was supposed to be playing the main event next week. And obviously that didn't happen because COVID stopped live poker in its tracks. And so you have to readjust. It's something that poker teaches you. You can't predict the future. You don't know what cards are still going to come. So you just do your best. And that's what I'm doing right now, just taking it one step at a time, focusing on the book. But who's to say that I can't do both sometime down the line and continue playing and writing, because I can write from anywhere in the world.
Yeah. In what ways? I don't know if it would. Like, I play poker once in a blue moon. I know how to play, but I don't dive in all that much. But as somebody that did, in what ways, if any, did poker, it's such a critical thinking sport in certain regard, did it change your personal life? Like, when you went away from the poker table, did you evaluate things differently? Do you approach things differently?
Absolutely. I mean, I think most fundamentally, it taught me how to think more probabilistically, how to actually understand what probabilities mean. It's so hard for the human brain to grasp, you know, what 2% is, what 10% is. Poker forces you to actually learn to do that well, because otherwise you're going to lose a lot of money. You have to figure out, you know, what's going on here? What is my edge? And it made me, I think, both a lot better at interpreting information, but also when I'm making decisions, it's really helped me not be too confident and to say things. I mean, people think I'm really strange when I say something like this, but I actually think it's very helpful. I'll say things like, well, I'm 75% sure of this, or like I'm 60% yeah. sure of this. I try to calibrate my opinions so that people know, you know, how much I'm actually willing to stand behind them. And I think the other thing it taught me.
I just can't fathom, Maria, not to cut you off, but I can't fathom like a family member saying, Maria, I need you to support me on this issue. Are you willing to commit? And you go, well, I'm 65% in. I got to calculate that other 35% that I don't like.
I haven't seen the turn card yet.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think there have been a few of those conversations. but the other thing I think it's taught me is to really separate the decision process from the decision outcome, to realize that all you can really do is focus on your process, on making the best decision you can with the information you have, and then the outcome's going to be what it's going to be. As long as you get your money in as a favorite, you did a good thing, and you should make that decision again, even though sometimes it's not going to go in the right way. You know, you're 75% to win, but the 25% is going to happen.
Right.
Even if you're 98% to win, the 2% is going to happen, and that's okay. So poker has really taught me to just focus on the things I can control and let go of the outcome. It's going to be what it's going to be, and there's nothing I can do about it.
Yeah, that's a great life philosophy. Maria Konnikova is our guest. Her newest book, The Biggest Bluff, How I Learned to Pay Attention, Master Myself, and Win, out now. Go check it out. New York Times bestselling author. Now, you mentioned you started playing online, and that's kind of how you learn. You're filming your sessions and that kind of stuff. Obviously, far different from when you're playing in person and at a table where everybody's looking at each other. Did you have a tell initially? Did you have to work on a tell? Like, how did that go for you?
I don't know if I had a tell initially. There was no one who could have told me. I hope I didn't. But I know that because I was so incredibly nervous, there were certain things, like my hands would shake when I had a big hand.
Yeah.
That wasn't great. And that was really hard to control. But everything was so new to me and everything was so exciting or scary. But I was really emotional at the beginning. And it's really difficult to control things like shaking hands. That's, you know, that's something that happens almost involuntarily. And it took some time for me to calm down, to gain confidence. And I think after that, I became a lot better. But I did actually work with a coach, Blake Eastman, who looks at physical tells. And he, by the time I worked with him, there was already a lot of televised footage of me playing. And he reviewed hours of me playing and helped me work on certain things that he thought might give away information.
Do you think you benefited going to some of these higher end tournaments? I mean, when you win $300,000, I mean, you're talking about some serious money play tournaments here. Do you think you benefit not knowing who anybody is when you show up to a table versus some of the other poker players being familiar with one another?
No, I actually think that's bad. I think it's as much information as you have is good. So having more information is never a bad thing. So if I know who someone is, I can look them up. I can do some homework. I can figure out how they play. I can analyze videos of them playing in the past and seeing, you know, how they act, how often they bluff, how aggressive they are. So it's actually great if I know them. It's even better if they don't know me. So the best thing is information asymmetry. When I know who I'm playing with, but they don't know who they're playing with. So I think I actually lost some of that edge as time went on, because at the beginning I was just a girl, and then I lost my anonymity as people figured out who I was.
Yeah.
And that worked against me.
How many hours a day were you putting in when you started learning and kind of progressed to the point where you played tournaments?
I was playing or studying 7 days a week, and my shortest day was 8 hours. It would be 8, 9, 10 hour days. Wow. I was really
you put in the work.
Full.
Wow.
Yeah, because I knew I had a limited amount of time, and I really wanted to give it my all. And I knew that if I just kind of said, do it a few hours here and there, I wasn't going to get results, and the book wouldn't have worked.
Right.
It would have just betrayed the whole project.
Yeah. Well, get you out on this one, Maria. Do you have another project that you're working on or another project in mind? I don't know if you want to do something similar to this with another kind of topic, but what are you thinking of a new project?
No, I actually, you know, when I said I was taking it one day at a time, I meant it.
Okay.
Right now I'm just focused on getting this book out in the world. It's taken 3 years of my life, and so I really want to put all of my brain power and all of my emotional capacity behind it. And then once that's done, then I'll pause and see what I want to do next. I'm staying open-minded.
I love it. That's awesome. Maria Konnikova.
Remarkable story, Maria.
The Biggest Bluff, How I Learned to Pay Attention, Master Myself, and Win. Go check out the book. She's a New York Times bestselling author, New Yorker contributor. Amazing story. We saw it, and we just thought we got to get her on and talk about this. Maria, thank you so much for the time. Best of luck with the book, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
There you go. Maria Konnikova.
She won $300,000.
$300,000. Makes you kind of want to put everything on hold, hire a coach, and learn for a year and go win $300K a year gambling.
I'll give this to her. I always think authors, there's an element of them that separate them from everybody else. That's one of them. Like, as much as I want to regularly break 90 on the golf course, I don't put anywhere near the amount of time I should to do that.
No,
I just play and I expect myself to get better the next.
You get pissed when you don't play well.
Right. To do that every day of the week for at the very minimum 8 hours makes sense that she won that kind of money.
Yeah, that was awesome, man. That was really fun. We'll podcast it if you missed any of it. But her book, it just came out yesterday. You go check it out. I think, $20, $25, something like that. They sent us an advanced copy, and I was reading through it the last couple of weeks. Amazing, amazing story to invest that much time, have it work out for you the way that it did. New York Times bestselling author. She's very smart. She's got a PhD, so she came in with a great base knowledge system, just not about poker. She's just very smart in general terms, but worked out for her. Won over $300,000, and now she's doing great with the book coming out yesterday.
Well, so if she's not married and somebody proposes, I hope she doesn't break down the percentage chances that it doesn't end well with that individual the way that she observes other things in her life.
Yeah, I want to get to a couple of NFL things to react. You can text in your thoughts, too. What'd you think of Maria? 503-250-1080. That's a fan text line. But a couple of NFL topics, including what they're going to do with the front row seats. Will it make up for the potential loss of fans in the upcoming year? Crunch time next on The Fan.
The pressure's on.
We have an opportunity to reestablish ourselves, get a big win. Not all is lost.
Who's feeling the heat?
Now we got to go home and make sure that we take care of business there. Shame on us if we don't.
It's crunch time. A look at the hottest topic in sports. Brought to you by Crunch Fitness. As low as $9.95 per month. No hassle, no pressure, no gimmicks, and no judgments.
Hey, Crunch Time, brought to you by Crunch Fitness with the Beaverton, Aloha, and Division locations back up and running. They got a special going on, $0 enrollment, $0 to the first 30 days. And I was at the Glorious House of Gains this morning.
Let's
How'd it go?
Go?
It went great. It felt great to be back in the gym.
It's your first time back, right?
First time back.
Did you wear
wear a mask.
How did that go?
I mean, it's not ideal to wear one while you're working out.
Did you pull it down to get a breath?
I didn't. Now, I had a really light workout with my trainer. I told him I got a golf tournament this weekend. Like, please don't kill me. I got bigger fish to fry in the coming days.
I
got to
play golf and booze, so let's go light on this workout.
Let's do some mobility and some stretching and just get the body nice and limber, ready to get some golf swings in.
Yeah, get in golf shape.
Exactly. That's what I'm going for.
You're not a muscle-bound guy.
No, it was, because the same thing I went with the haircut yesterday, wearing the mask for stuff. It's a little weird, not going to lie. It's going to take some getting used to. Not everybody was wearing a mask in the gym. Mm. I wore a mask because I work with a personal trainer and I'm like 6 feet away from him I can't socially distance from him.
Yeah.
So we had our little corner in the gym. It felt great. They're doing great. Like they check your temperature on the way in. They gave me a little forehead scan to make sure I wasn't too hot and I wasn't over 100 degrees. So I got in after that. Then they wipe all the stuff down before you use any of it. It felt great to get back in the gym, back at Crunch today. Good to get a little workout in. Let's get to a couple of NFL stories, and maybe one baseball one that kind of ties in. Have you seen what the NFL is planning to do to potentially make up some money this year if fans are not allowed to fully pack a stadium?
Fans aren't going to be at games, but sure, tell us.
Well, we'll wait on that.
Will we?
I think we will.
We haven't had a second wave yet, and the first one's still kicking our ass.
Yeah, that's true. Have you seen the case in the numbers in Houston lately and what the Astros owner came out and said, despite those case numbers?
Probably something really idiotic, the way Gene Smith is talking about having 40,000 Ohio State fans at football games.
Got to put butts in the seats, man. They got to make money. Got to put butts in the seats, right?
I'm pretty convinced these people are saying this so they can get people to buy tickets at a slightly discounted price while knowing they're probably not going to be able to utilize them. So they can just say, your tickets are good for next year.
Yeah. Well, before we get to the fan thing, it's not a huge deal, but they're for the first 6 to 8 rows, it sounds like in every NFL stadium, they are going to cover them with a tarp. Partially, they're probably saying to keep fans away from the players as much as they can. But also, they are going to, guess what, cover them in sponsors. Hence, new revenue for the NFL. So think of
you want to sponsor our empty seats.
Our empty seats. Going to put a little tarp over there. Going to slap your logo on top of that bad boy.
What section are you? Oh, you're in SeatGeek. SeatGeek's over here.
Yeah, it's no longer section 1 or 2. You're now
Ron Tonkin Toyota. Yeah. You're over there in the corner.
You're in the Best Buy section over there. So I saw that on the Sports Business Journal today. So they're going to cover the first 6 to 8 rows of every NFL stadium. Slap some logos on it. No, the NFL though did come out and say
the NBA should do this, by the way, for their court.
They should. It'd be smart.
Put
right?
sponsors all over the court.
Right.
Who cares?
And on the seats if you want to. Yeah. There's not going to be any fans in the seats. But no, the NFL came out. Daniel Kaplan, I believe, was the one that reported this thing. An unnamed NFL source told him that NFL attendance this year will be a state-by-state, county-by-county decision. It will not be a one-size-fits-all philosophy.
We'll see about that.
And that also goes in line with, as I mentioned, Jim Crane, who is the owner of the Astros, who I'm sure has just been on really tough financial times, going to 2 World Series and like 4 ALCS appearances in the last 4 years and letting big free agent pitchers walk and not paying them. He came out with a quote saying, only thing we have to do that can counter the team's lost revenue is to get people in the building and sell some tickets, sell some merchandise, sell some cold beer, whatever they'd like. He continued, that's the plan. We'd still have to go through the player protocol. We're still focused on that. I think the intent at some point is to get the fans into the ballpark.
That's the intent. That don't mean it's going to happen. I think they're going to play. I'm not sold. They're having fans at these games. And this is primarily going to be driven on a state-by-state basis. So I'll tell you, if the Chargers can't have any fans in their stands, they're going to bitch about it. Who cares? If the Dallas Cowboys can't have fans in their stands, it becomes a serious issue. If the New England Patriots, you know, the popular vocal owners of this league that really dictate things, that's what's going to be dependent on fans. Because there's no way Jerry Jones is okaying him not having fans if Texas continues to just ruin this whole thing. Mm-hmm. And then allowing Minnesota, let's say Minneapolis is okay. They have a certain number of fans. The Vikings can have home games to a certain extent. I can't fathom Jerry Jones is cool with that. So, yeah, I know what they're saying today. I get it. I do not foresee fans at games.
Kind of the angle we've gone on with college football through the last couple of weeks and months, too, is them saying it's going to be a state-by-state. Some teams, Ole Miss has come out saying we're going to pack the stadium. We don't care. Arkansas has said we're going to pack the stadium. We don't care. We obviously are not.
We know the states who don't care.
Right.
Their numbers are starting to speak to that.
Right, and we're obviously not anywhere near that here on the West Coast, and things are playing out a little bit differently, so we'll wait and see what kind of fan totals, if any, we can get at Washington, Oregon, Oregon State, Washington State kind of games. But this to me is a very fascinating offshoot of the entire thing returning is when the NBA has a bubble, we know there's not going to be fans. These sports that are not dealing with a bubble that are traveling from city to city, if you get some markets that don't care, they fudge the numbers or they just try and pretend like nothing's actually happening.
Florida's fudging the numbers right now.
That's going on in a lot of different places. Like bars and restaurants are open up. Like they don't care. They're allowing rallies to go on. It's like, dude, pack the stadium. What the hell do we care? If you get that in some markets in baseball, how the players feel about that, having stadiums, I'm sure they would want to play in front of fans, but they also want to be safe. I find that a fascinating offshoot of the whole thing.
Well, baseball, you know, football and baseball could probably have this if they get to the point where they can have a certain number of fans. I'm wondering, do you designate them in the, you talk about closing off the first few rows, right, and doing advertising. Mm-hmm. If I'm baseball, the fans are sitting in the outfield or on the side upper decks.
Yeah, you pack them up a little bit higher up in the stadium.
And yeah, the ticket prices will drop a little bit given the circumstance that they can't sit behind home plate, but I'm not messing with putting players or fans near dugouts,
front row seats,
home
right
plates.
The dugout,
yeah, like I'm almost canceling the entire section and saying, you want to sit in right field? Cool. You want to sit in left field? Cool. Center field, upper deck, foul pole lines? Cool. But I think if you really want the season to go on and finish, yeah, I mean, you're already biting the bullet, man. It's not like fans of 4,000 per game are really going to help you lose that much less money. So I would almost rather there be no fans or you really dictate where they sit.
So Jim Crane, the owner of the Astros, saying they're trying to put plans together to have fans in the ballpark this year. So that's how they got to counter the revenue losses that they've had. And the NFL, an unnamed source, said that it will be a state-by-state, county-by-county decision to see how many fans go to games in certain markets. Crunch Time is brought to you by Crunch Fitness. The Beaverton Aloha division locations back open up. I was there this morning. It felt great. $0 enrollment, $0 for the first 30 days. So stop by, check them out, crunch.com. Loaded final hour. We'll get to Statter Story coming up at 2:15. Got some other sports leftovers from yesterday. I want to start, though. There was an anonymous GM survey in the NBA, and I found some of the answers pretty interesting about the return for the sport, what the GMs are saying about it, what they're thinking about the league, and what it would mean to crown a champion or not crown a champion in the upcoming season. We'll start the final hour there next. Don't go anywhere. Dirt and Sprague on 1080 The Fan.